This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. 50 years ago this week, President John F. Kennedy, a son of Massachusetts, was assassinated. All this month, WBUR has been looking back at his presidency, listening to his speeches, and exploring his connections to this state.
We're going to begin our program today looking at the late president's Massachusetts political roots. Although Kennedy came from a family with a deep history in the Bay State, Kennedy himself spent most of his early years in New York and in a boarding school in Connecticut. So by the time he made his first run for Congress in Massachusetts, he had to fend off charges of being a political outsider, even a carpetbagger.
In spite of that, of course, he became a Massachusetts congressman, senator, and president. And just days before his inauguration, he returned to Boston and before a packed state house declared himself a man from Massachusetts.
And so it is that I carry with me from this state to that high and lonely office to which I now succeed more than fond memories or firm friendships, the enduring quality of Massachusetts, the common threads woven by the pilgrim and the Puritan, the fisherman and the farmer, the Yankee and the immigrant, will not be and could not be forgotten in this nation's executive mansion. They are an indelible part of my life, my convictions, my view of the past, and my hopes for the future.
So if Massachusetts was his home, how did it influence him as a politician? How did this state, with its political loyalty split between Brahmin and working-class immigrant traditions, help shape JFK as a young congressman, senator, and eventually president?
And to explore those questions and more, we're joined by Thurston Clark. He's a Kennedy historian, the author of several books. His latest, JFK's Last 100 Days, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President. And Thurston Clark, thank you very much for joining us. Great pleasure to have you.
Yes, it's my pleasure to be here, too, and to discuss this subject, which is one that interests me a great deal.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Mm-hmm. Also with us is our own Jack Beatty, journalist, author. He's well known to our listeners as news analyst for NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook. He's the author of several books, including The Rascal King, a biography of the legendary Boston mayor, James Michael Curley. Jack, thanks so much for joining us. Really great
Hello.
To have you.
Hello, Anthony and Professor Clark and Meghna.
Thurston Clark, not Professor.
Right.
Hello, Jack Beatty.
All right. Well, we're all on first-name basis from this point forward, if that's okay.
Right.
So let's start with this idea that JFK has long been considered a son of Massachusetts. Thurston Clark, I'll start with you. Was there something fundamental about the political culture of his time in this state that shaped who he was?
Yes, there was. But before we even get to that, I've got to throw a vote in for Cape Cod, because Hyannisport was really Kennedy and the family. He considered that his real home. Mm. That was where he went every single summer. They went there for Thanksgiving. It was the other houses, Palm Beach and New York, they were all transit. He was never in the same place very long. But that was the same place he went back every summer, where he learned to swim, where he learned to sail. It was a house that was also full of ghosts, the ghosts of his dead brother and sister. I mean, it was a very important place for him. It was the anchor for the Kennedy family and the anchor for him. So his anchor was really in Massachusetts.
Hmm.
Now, as far as how he was shaped by Massachusetts, I think that the most important thing it did to him was it encouraged this egalitarian streak in Kennedy. Now, that's a funny thing to have somebody say about a man who was the son of probably the richest Irish American in the world at the time, who had never washed his own shirts or made his own bed. But he was. In fact, the Secret Service head, Huey Brown, when he retired in 1961, end of 61, he said that he thought that Kennedy was the most egalitarian president he'd come in contact with, and that included FDR and particularly Harry Truman, which is a surprising thing to say.
Mm. So what was going on here, though, specifically, mm-hmm. that sort of spoke to that egalitarian streak?
Exactly. Well, most importantly, it was the district that he represented, the district he ran to represent, which was a district of stevedores, of longshoremen, of blue-collar workers in East Boston and Somerville, Charlestown. There's this moment when he's addressing one of his first rallies there, and he looks down at the people in front of him, and he says in a soft voice to his friend Dave Powers, "These are the kind of people I want to represent." Now, that wasn't just an aha moment for him, because we know that when he was in the Navy, he was considered by the other people in PT-109, the people who served under him, to be completely without kind of the pretensions of the average officer. He scraped the boat with them. He kept in contact with the enlisted men after the war. So this whole egalitarian thing was something that was there beforehand. It was there, actually, with Joe and Rose Kennedy, who wanted to raise their children to be like the Brahmins, not ostentatious, not showing off their wealth, not having cars until their friends had them or bikes until their friends had them. So representing this district in Boston really encouraged that strain in Kennedy.
Really interesting. Jack, I'd love to get you to chime in on this. This idea that Thurston talked about, this egalitarian streak impulse versus, this son of great privilege and great influence, obviously, coming from his father, for example.
Well, you could see that in flashes. I remember, I think, in one of the debates with Richard Nixon, the question of the minimum wage came up. If I'm not mistaken, it was $1.25 an hour. And when he was asked, should it be raised, he just said, no one can live on that. It's not possible. He didn't get into any of the economic arguments. Well, on the one hand, it was just a dismissal. Mm. How could anyone live on anything like that? And, of course, famously, in West Virginia, he turned on that egalitarian charm to capture the state in a decisive primary. Of course, helped a great deal by his father's money and by Jimmy Roosevelt campaigning with him. But yes, I think that really was about, if you want to think of that district, the face of it is Tip O'Neill. Mm-hmm. Tip O'Neill succeeded him there, and Tip O'Neill, I think, stood for that lunch bucket Democratic tradition.
Well, how did he ingratiate himself with the people in that district? Because, of course, he faced the label of carpetbagger initially from his opponents when he first ran there. Thurston, how serious was that charge, and how seriously did he have to take it?
Well, he did have to take it seriously, and one of the ways he got around it was the way he learned how to connect with his blue-collar audiences. Deidre Henderson, who was one of his informal advisors and was in liaison for him with the academic community, she told me she was struck by how people like Muggsy O'Leary, who was his driver in Boston and went to Washington with him, what she called the real people, the cops, the staff in the kitchen, instinctively felt that he liked him. That he liked them, and they returned his affection. And you see this again and again. He spent the summer in summer weekend in 1959 in Newport, and Jackie is off traveling, and he gets tired of the party, the black tie party. He goes into the kitchen and he hangs out with the help, and afterwards he writes to Jackie, "I was taken into the kitchen, introduced to the help who were just over from Ireland, and found them more attractive than the guests." Well, this is a constant, thing that happens with Kennedy. He has monogrammed handkerchiefs, but he's embarrassed by the monogram, so he always hides them in his pocket so the monogram's not showing. He redesigned Air Force One. Fantastic. He was the one who picked the color schemes, who did all of this. He was a real control freak on how his presidency looked, and yet he told Ken O'Donnell, "I don't want any photographers taking pictures of Air Force One inside because it looks too much like a rich man's plane."
Wow. Well, let's listen to a bit of tape on this. This gets back to this issue of early on, 1946, he's running for that seat in Congress. And this is Mark Dalton, a Kennedy friend, a member of his staff from 46 until 52. It comes to us courtesy of the JFK Presidential Library and the radio documentary project, We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives. So here's Mark Dalton explaining how his supporters responded to these charges of being a carpetbagger, being an outsider.
"When anybody tried to say that the Kennedys didn't come from the district or that the Fitzgeralds didn't come from the district, that was treated as sheer nonsense. And then even if they felt he had not spent much time in the district, they were very proud to have a young man of this stature, a returning war hero, run as a candidate in the district."
So a couple of interesting points in there. First of all, the depth of the sort of Kennedy history in this state and city. But talk about that status as a returning war hero and how important that was. Do you want to start with that, Thurston?
Yes, tremendously important. There's the moment where he was not a natural campaigner. He was ill. His speeches were awkward. He gave a very awkward speech to a group of Gold Star mothers. And finally, at the end, he didn't connect with them at all. Finally, at the end, he said, "Well, I know how you feel because my mother is also a Gold Star mother." And with that, some of them cried. They rushed up to grab his hand. He connected with them, and he kept doing this. One of the big issues for him was housing for veterans. And he, very early on as a representative, he clashed with the American Legion, defied the American Legion that was against a bill that he thought was going to provide low-cost housing for veterans. And in fact, he called the American Legion a legislative drummer boy for the real estate lobby. People told him, "You're crazy, you can't cross the Legion," but he was willing to do it because he felt so strongly about veterans issues.
Interesting. Jack, I was talking to you, I remember, just a few days ago, and we were talking about a couple of things we would talk about in this segment, and you were reminding me about seeing JFK campaigning in Boston a while back, and I just wanted to ask you about, to pick up on Thurston Clark's point about him being an awkward campaigner. I'm wondering what you saw, when you saw him, and if it was consistent with that.
Well, no, that would have been in 1960, just before the election, and he was by then a practiced hand indeed. But to get back to that earlier period, you know, when he came into Congress, when he started to campaign in Massachusetts, he said, quote, "I'm a stranger in the city of my birth." He was simply, you know, putting a lantern on his troubles that he couldn't be denied. He hadn't been here in a long time, but he did make the case for those spiritual roots. And on both sides of the family, of course, on the Fitzgerald side, on the Kennedy side, he had that rich political tradition that went right into Massachusetts politics, so he could represent himself truthfully as a son of Massachusetts, a prodigal son come home.
Yeah, interesting. What was his relationship with, and let me go back to that early race for Congress, Thurston Clark, with Massachusetts Democrats, because it wasn't easy initially, right? He had sort of disdain for the routine politics and the party hacks, right?
Yes, he did. And in fact, it didn't necessarily get that much easier with some people. I mean, he famously refused to sign a petition to President Truman to commute the sentence of Mayor Thomas Curley for fraud in Boston. And that didn't win him any love from the local politicians. And also, he was notoriously reluctant to reward reward people with favors and patronage for their loyalty. And this led one Boston politician that I read about to complain, "Kennedy doesn't pay for anybody's funeral and seldom goes to wakes, and he never seems to get anybody a job. What kind of a politician is that?" Well, it was true. And this compared, of course, to his grandfather, Honey Fitz, the mayor of Boston, who knew how to do that very well. In fact, Kennedy's own, he even slighted his own family. While he was in the Senate, his maternal uncle, Thomas Fitzgerald, continued to work as a uniform toll taker on the Mystic River Bridge. And an unemployed cousin was so certain that Kennedy wouldn't help him that he went to Governor Foster Furcolo instead. So Kennedy was pretty...
Really interesting. One of the things that comes out when I'm sort of looking back and reading about his early races was, obviously, son of privileged, enormously helped by his father and all of his millions. But he took that first race incredibly seriously, worked his tail off. And in fact, we've got another piece of tape from the Kennedy Library. This is JFK himself talking about how he approached his first congressional race. And it's a recording of him talking to journalists Ben Bradley and Jim Cannon back in 1960 in Washington. And he's talking about how hard he worked to win that first race for Congress. Let's listen.
It's a long and laborious job, particularly in a primary where you don't have the party label to help you in that picking between people. Now, I have the advantage, the great advantage, of having a well-known name. And I worked extremely hard for a long period of time. My disadvantage was I was an outsider.
Why?
Because I'd come from New York, I was living in a hotel, I'd never lived in the district, really. My roots were there, but I'd lived in New York for 10 years, then went to Harvard, not particularly a popular institution then, in the 11th Congressional District.
So the tape faded out a little bit there, but Jack, he's talking about being an outsider. He went to Harvard. He never really lived there. He came from a well-known family, but he didn't have that immediate connection with the district.
No. And yes, he had an egalitarian touch, but you probably, I don't know, Thurston, if this is correct, you probably had a scratch to reach it a bit. I mean, his background was not among the common people, to put it plainly.
No, absolutely not.
And that Navy experience may be as close as he got, which was, of course, a pretty intense one, and he was serving with a wide range of people. But most of his life had been spent in gilded company. And so finding the common touch, I think, it just couldn't have come naturally, and he did find it, and you know, that's a recurrent story in that family, the famous anecdote about Ted Kennedy and when he ran for the Senate in 1962, is that his opponent Edwin McCormick said, "You'd never been employed a day in your life," and the next day Ted was shaking hands at the Four Rivers Shipyard in Quincy, and a fella grabbed his hand and he said, "Listen, buddy, you haven't missed a thing."
Well, can I just
Thurston Clark, go ahead.
Can I just add that that he certainly was trying, because he had to have a legal residence in the district in Boston, and he took a very small apartment on Bowdoin Street right near the State House, and people who visited were just shocked. There were wobbly tables, the chairs were broken, there was an old Victrola, and it was a dump, and visitors were shocked that somebody like him would live in such a dump. But on the other hand, it's where he kept his college yearbooks, his Navy sword. I mean, it was the one place, in fact, where he could come back and he knew that room was his, because even on Cape Cod, the Kennedys never knew what room they were going to have, because Rose would move them around depending on how many people were in the house. So they didn't have a room that was their bedroom. This was Kennedy's only real room, this tip on Bowdoin Street.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Let me get back to how he managed to be successful, sort of playing off that last cut where he said he had to work incredibly hard. We've got another great piece of tape from John Droney. This was one of Kennedy's aides during that race. And he talked about the ground game in that political race. And when we talk about the ground game these days, it's sort of well established. You go door to door, you meet voters, you talk to them. From my understanding, and after we listen to this tape, Thurston Clark, correct me if I'm wrong, but it wasn't that normal then, and Kennedy did it. So here's John Droney talking about that race.
The key to it was we were probably the first group that ever did any real registering of voters. And we got a tremendous registration drive. We went door to door. And they say they do that in campaigns, but they seldom do it. But he did it in his campaign because he had the people who were willing to do it for him.
Thurston Clark, do you want to comment about that?
Well, no, he did do it, and that's how he met, actually, Dave Powers. He went up and down the stairs of the Triple Deckers in Charlestown shaking hands. He did it himself. I want to also say that I didn't want to give the impression when I talked earlier that he wouldn't give patronage or favors, that he wasn't a hard-nosed politician, because he certainly was. He learned how to do it during this campaign, during this door-to-door canvassing. In fact, it was the famous comment about him later, about 15 years later, his friend Red Fay said he could drive down a street with him in Boston and he could tell you which stores and which houses had his poster in them 15 years ago and which one didn't. Fletcher Nabel, the journalist, called him a very earthy, cynical politician and said that whenever someone had crossed him, quote, his voice would get sharp, his eyes would narrow. You could tell a big-time grudge was going on. And Nabel added that his blonde eyebrows gave him the eyes of a snake, not a very appealing talk. And Nabel was very fond of him, too. So there was a side to Kennedy that was a pretty hard politician as well.
I'm really curious about, we played that wonderful cut from his City on a Hill speech when he was speaking to the Massachusetts, members of the Massachusetts legislature. Beautiful language talking about the enduring qualities of Massachusetts, the common threads woven by the Pilgrim and the Puritan, the fisherman, the farmer, the Yankee, and the immigrant, and so on and so forth, plays beautifully in Massachusetts. I'm wondering how a speech like that played nationally. I mean, to evoke sort of the wonderful sort of deep history of Massachusetts. Because these days, when a politician evokes Massachusetts, they do so at their own peril nationally, right? And I'm just wondering what it was like then.
Well, I'll tell you, I think some of his speechwriters, it might have been Ted Sorensen too, were kind of upset that he used some lines in that speech that they'd planned to put in the inaugural address, specifically when he says that history wouldn't judge them on the basis of color or creed or party affiliation, nor would their competence and loyalty and stature suffice. Instead, what he called, quote, the high court of history would measure them by answers to four questions. Were they men of courage, men of judgment, men of dedication, and men of integrity? Well, I don't know how many of the Massachusetts legislators were really men of integrity, but anyway, that's what Kennedy told them. It was pretty tough medicine.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a little more tape from Kennedy himself. So this is New England's salute to the president, October 19th, 1963. He delivered a speech at the State House during his last trip to Boston a month before he died. He talked about his pride in being a Democrat from this state. This is from that same speech we heard at the beginning of this segment.
I must say it's a constant source of pride to me that I come from this state, that I represented Massachusetts, that I'm identified with this state. It has the longest and I think most distinguished history. But I think in 1963, as well as the last 30 years, as well as the last 150 years, this state and the people in it have been willing to meet their responsibilities, and particularly those who are Democrats.
So here's my question about this this cut, and I'm really curious about this. I mean, as we mentioned, he sort of butted heads with the Democratic establishment early on in his career in Massachusetts. Did that Democratic establishment change? Did Kennedy change what it means to be a Massachusetts Democrat?
Doc, do you want to go? I've got one other.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you have to see where he fit into the political firmament here. You know, on the one hand, in his time, you had Yankee Republicans, really Brahmin Republicans, Robert Bradford. He was a governor. He was a descendant. His family had come over on the Mayflower. Leverett Saltonstall, the other senator, family on the Mayflower, or just about. Christian Herter, old Yankee New England family. Mm. On the other side, you had the ethnic Democrats, Paul Dever, a governor, Foster Furcolo, Italian on one side, Irish on the other, governor. And Kennedy was a kind of synthesis of them, you know? He was sort of the Irish Brahmin. I mean, he had the Harvard degree, he had the manners, he had the money, he had the tailoring. And he had the reserve. I mean, he was a very much more a reserved ethnic politician than, say, a Tip O'Neill or someone like that. So, but by reason of style alone, he stood out and stood apart, not only from the old guard Republicans, but especially from the ethnic Democrats.
I heard him. Yeah, go ahead, Thurston Clark.
Let's not forget that the one of the real Massachusetts influences on him was his three closest political advisors, Larry O'Brien, Ken O'Donnell, and Dave Powers, the so-called Irish Mafia. They all came from Massachusetts. He'd all picked that. He picked all of them up in Massachusetts.
Hmm. I heard him described in the research I was doing for this segment as the white hope of the non-organization Democrats. Does that mean something to you, Thurston Clark? Non-organization Democrats?
Well, it does. I mean, that's again the fact that he defied the Democratic politicians, the establishment in Massachusetts, defied them on issues such as the St. Lawrence Seaway, for example, where he thought it was he was the only congressman, member of the congressional delegation, to support the St. Lawrence Seaway. For 20 years before that, every single Democrat had been against the St. Lawrence Seaway. I mean, I think that he was coming around in his final. Particularly in his final year, you know, Robert Frost urged him in a meeting at the White House at the beginning of his inauguration, after his inauguration. He before he left, he turned to Kennedy and he said, "Be more Irish than Harvard."
Hmm. Interesting.
And Kennedy kept that with him, and he even mentioned it when he spoke at Amherst College.
Well, we're almost out of time. I want to wrap up with one final tape from President Kennedy. This is, again, on his final visit to Massachusetts. Let's listen to this.
But I am not here to bid farewell to Massachusetts. For 43 years, whether I was in London or in Washington, or in the South Pacific, or elsewhere. This has been my home, and God willing, wherever I serve, this shall remain my home.
Okay. And he goes on to say, it was here my grandparents were born. It is here I hope my grandchildren will be born. Let me ask you both, I'll start with you, Thurston, if he had survived the presidency, mm-hmm. do you think he intended to return to Massachusetts to live out his days?
No. I mean, I think he would have returned to Cape Cod. Mm. I think he would have spent a lot of time, as he did before. I think he wouldn't have just been coming up for the weekends. I think he would have spent a lot of time there. He talked about writing. He talked about serving as he even joked once about being ambassador to Italy because it would please Jackie. So I think it would have been quite a while before he returned to Massachusetts.
All right. That's Thurston Clark, Kennedy historian, the author of JFK's Last 100 Days, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President. Thurston Clark, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, journalist, author, friend of WBUR, On Point News analyst. Thank you, Jack, so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up, as the 50th anniversary of the assassination approaches, how we will have more on that. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
And now we continue our series, November 1963, listening back to some of the defining moments of John F. Kennedy's presidency.
Today, WBUR's Kelly Horan recalls Kennedy's peace speech, considered one of the most important addresses of the 20th century, which redirected the course of the Cold War. The date was June 10th, 1963, when Kennedy delivered the commencement address at American University.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war, not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave.
It is hailed as one of the most important speeches of the 20th century, a call for world peace by a president who knows well how terrifyingly close America and the world had come to nuclear war.
I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on Earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
Our problems are man-made, Kennedy says. Therefore, they can be solved by man. This speech is a striking departure from Kennedy's previous Cold War addresses, and for an audience reared on Presidents Truman and Eisenhower's Cold War rhetoric, this message is entirely new.
Some say that it is useless to speak of peace, or world law, or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation.
In the months since the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962, Kennedy and Khrushchev maintained a secret correspondence about nuclear disarmament. In a letter to the Soviet leader dated April 11, 1963, Kennedy writes, "Both you and I have grave responsibilities to our families and to all of mankind. The pressure from those who have a less patient and peaceful outlook are great. But I assure you of my own determination to work to strengthen world peace."
And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
In this speech, Kennedy announces upcoming test ban treaty talks in Moscow, and he heralds America's unilateral end of atmospheric nuclear testing. With our hopes go the hopes of all mankind, he says.
This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
Excerpts of President John F. Kennedy's commencement address at American University on June 10th, 1963. Our November 1963 series is produced and reported by WBUR's Kelly Horan with help from WBUR's George Hicks. You can find a link to all our reports in the series at radioboston.org and tune into Morning Edition and Radio Boston tomorrow to hear Kennedy's landmark civil rights address.
And stay with us coming up, Della May, the hard-driving all-female bluegrass band, live in our studio. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.